It came to him slowly because he was so damn tired. Vietnam, Hazleton, the motorcycles, the plane ride home with the smell of death, halfway around the earth, the exhaustion after landing in Baltimore the previous evening. Only then did it hit him. He realized where he was now. He was home. His new place, a modern condominium overlooking the Potomac River in Old Town Alexandria, Virginia. He barely knew his own home. He'd been traveling so much, so it took him a while to get his bearings. Finally, he rolled out of bed and walked toward the kitchen, hoping he could remember the way in the dark. Jack had bought this place on Aronico Street 6 weeks earlier, but it still felt brand new to him. He'd been undergoing a battery of advanced tradecraft and operations training that took him all over the world. Until last week, that is, when he and most other members of his unit rushed off to Asia on special assignment. Ryan realized he'd spent only 6 or 7 nights at his Alexandria address since moving in, so it came as no real surprise that he'd been disoriented rising early on the morning after an exhausting flight around the world. To combat the cobwebs in his head now, he threw a pod into his coffee machine, filled the reservoir with water, flipped the device on, and stuck a cup under the spout. As he stood there with his eyes closed, the machine began to spew the hot, black liquid into the cup. Jack had become a bit of a coffee snob, and he knew pod coffee couldn't compete with real coffee in a taste contest. But in a speed race, the pod won by a wide margin. He stood in his dark kitchen and drank his coffee black and molten. It burned the back of his throat, but he needed the jolt because he could tell his brain was still somewhere back in Asia, and he had to go to work today. Thunder boomed on the street outside, and Ryan headed back upstairs to get in the shower. Ryan had lived in Columbia, Maryland for several years, but he moved here for the simple reason that his place of business had moved here. For years, the offices of Hendley Associates had been north of D.C., in West Odenton, Maryland, but that building had been shuttered months back, after Chinese operatives learned of the existence of the campus. A unit of Chinese special forces raided the property, killing several employees, and even though the threat had been repelled, both the White Side Hendley Associates and the Dark Side campus had closed up shop to prevent any further compromise. Jerry Hendley had spent most of the intervening months looking for a new space, until finally deciding on a building here in Old Town Alexandria. The new Hendley Associates property was on North Fairfax Street, in a 4-story brick Federalist office building with views of the Potomac River and the distant D.C. skyline. The building turned out to be perfect for Hendley's needs. It had been built as the home of a government intelligence contractor run by a former U.S. Army general, before he'd left it behind to move his offices to an address inside the district. Ryan dressed for work in a charcoal gray pinstriped suit and a red silk tie. His formal attire contrasted a little with his thick, dark beard and his slightly longer-than-collar-length brown hair, but the beard and the hair were more important to him now than the suit. His father was president of the United States, so Jack had made it a focus of his attention to do whatever he could to avoid notice and attention. And in this task, he had enjoyed near mission success. In the past few months, only 2 or 3 times had anyone stepped up to him to inform him of the fact he was Jack Ryan, Jr., son of the president. After he checked his suit in the mirror for lint, he stepped over to his nightstand and hefted a black pistol in a black leather holster from its nightly resting place by his clock. He slipped it into the waistband of his pants on his right side, then slid a small leather pouch containing an extra magazine for the weapon on his left side. The operators of the campus appreciated the relocation to Virginia for a few reasons, but one of the main perks was that they could easily and legally carry firearms here, unlike in nearby D.C. and in Maryland, which were both much more restrictive. Jack's main carry weapon was the Austrian Glock 19, a squat, black, nearly featureless automatic pistol that carried 16 rounds of 9mm hollow-point ammunition. It was a simple and effective weapon, without a lot of bells and whistles, such as a manual external safety. If one kept the gun loaded, which one should if one carried it for defensive purposes, any time the trigger was pulled, a round would fire. There were no extra levers, switches, or buttons to slow down the process. Ryan considered himself much more of an intelligence analyst than a gunfighter, but he had entered into gun battles multiple times in his years with the campus. It went with the job, so Ryan went armed as often as he could possibly get away with it. Jack Jr. popped open his umbrella on his covered back deck, and he locked his back door. Then he shouldered his backpack and exited his property through his rear garden gate. He walked past his black Mercedes E-Class in the driveway and continued down the street. Ryan enjoyed walking to work. Inside the Beltway, it was the closest thing to paradise anyone had managed to find, and even in the rain, it beat getting stuck in morning traffic. 10 minutes later, he shook out his umbrella at the entrance to Hendley Associates and stood in front of a bulletproof glass door until he was buzzed into the lobby by one of four guards inside. A dozen armed men were employed as the security force of Hendley Associates. They were all ex-CIA paramilitary operations officers with top-secret security clearances who'd taken contracts as static security in the private sector. They knew the organization they protected was a Sub Rosa intelligence outfit, and they knew they weren't supposed to know more than that, save for one extra item of interest that was quite relevant to their positions. The son of the President of the United States was an analyst for the company. Jack Jr. arrived each morning at 8 a.m., unless, of course, he was out of town. No one could imagine he had any operational capacity for the company, but then again, none of the static security was aware of the true scope of the work done by the men on the top floor. The security force here just assumed that, on occasion, POTUS's kid had to go into the field to conduct some sort of financial analytics task for Jerry Hendley. The director of security for Hendley Associates was a 47-year-old ex-Army Ranger named Bryce Jennings. Jennings was no stranger to the world of clandestine security. After the Army, he spent a decade in the CIA protecting secure facilities for the agency. In his security career, he'd been bombed in Baghdad, shot at in Kabul. He'd fought off an attempted overrun of a special mission compound in Sana'a and another outside Manila, and he'd once helped save the U.S. ambassador to Tunisia from an insider attack when a local police captain tried to kidnap him at gunpoint. Jennings had seen a lot in his career, but he was happy to leave that behind now so that he could spend more time with his wife and young daughter back in the United States. He'd jumped at the chance to come back stateside to take this new position, but he solemnly guaranteed Jerry Hendley he would treat his responsibilities here in the building in Alexandria, Virginia, as seriously as he would were they in Alexandria, Egypt. Ryan was buzzed in after a moment, and he entered the small lobby and then dropped off his umbrella in a rack. Bryce was behind the desk by the elevator. "Morning, Jack." He'd tried calling him Mr. Ryan the first half dozen or so days he'd greeted him, but Ryan corrected him each time. Finally, Jennings relented, so now it was just Jack. "Hey, Bryce," Ryan said. "Nats and Phillies tonight, if the rain moves out." "Damn right, I'll be there. Phillies have been hitting, but we got Gonzalez on the mound. No problem." Ryan was an Orioles fan himself, but he knew Jennings lived and breathed the Washington Nationals and took his 6-year-old daughter to every game he could when he wasn't working. As Ryan made his way to the elevator, he said, "Good luck tonight, but the Orioles will be down for a doubleheader Saturday. You'd better pray for rain then." Jennings's eyes narrowed, feigning seriousness. "You really ought to root for the home team, you know. Your dad, too." Jack entered the elevator and turned around. "Oh, we do. D.C. isn't home for either of us, Bryce." Jennings shook his head as the doors closed. After the Chinese attack on the campus, the Sub Rosa Intelligence Organization had become a smaller, leaner outfit, and their offices reflected this. Fewer than 75 men and women worked in the building, and half of these worked exclusively in the white side. The first two floors of the building were devoted exclusively to the financial trading business. The third floor housed IT for both entities, as well as conference rooms and a small break room. The top floor was the location of Jerry Hendley's large executive office suite, as well as the offices of the campus. An equipment locker and the company's mainframe computer, as well as an operations center for the campus, were housed in the secure basement of the property. Jack's elevator stopped on the second floor, and Gavin Beery stepped in and pushed the third floor button. Gavin Beery was the IT director of the campus, and as much as the operational side of the house hated to admit it, the campus would not exist without him. Morning, Gav.
Welcome home, Ryan. You boys have a nice little vacay?
Normally, Beery supported campus operations from his banks of computers here in Virginia, but the Vietnam op had come up quickly and Gavin hadn't been involved. Even so, Gavin Beery was cleared for anything that happened to the campus operators, so Ryan knew he didn't need to keep quiet about the operation. Jack said, "Oh, it was a blast. Our subject got murdered right in front of me. Ding and Sam got shot at, and Clark flattened a dude with a rental car. How was your weekend?" The elevator dinged as it stopped, and the doors opened on Gavin's floor. He stood there with his mouth half open, not sure if Ryan was serious. Finally, he said, "Sure am sorry I missed that up." Gavin had gone out with the team a few times in his career to provide computer support to their operations, and due to these limited forays into the field, he considered himself something of a full-fledged spook. The rest of the team found this to be comical, although the computer geek had done an admirable job in the field. "It's your floor, Gav," Jack said. "Right," Gavin replied as he stepped out into the third floor hall, still not sure if Ryan was pulling his leg about what had happened overseas or not. Jack headed to his fourth floor office to drop his bag on his way to the kitchen, but as he walked up the hall, he saw someone sitting on the edge of his desk. As he got closer, he realized it was his cousin, Dominic Caruso. Jack hadn't seen Dom in nearly 3 months. Dom was an operations officer here at the campus, same as Jack, but the operators had all been off in different directions in specialized individual training, each on their own rotation around the world. Dom had stayed out on an evolution longer than the other men, and he and Jack hadn't spoken or emailed each other in weeks. The two men embraced. "Good to see you, cuz," Caruso said. After a post-embrace chest bump, a silly move they'd started doing as a joke, Ryan said, "You too." "Damn, Dom. You've been training a long time. Me and the other guys have actually been out working while you've been rolling around on a cushy judo mat somewhere." Caruso cocked his head. "Really? Jerry didn't tell you?" Now Ryan cocked his own head. "Tell me what?" Caruso hesitated. Finally, he said, "Never mind. If Jerry didn't tell you, then you must not need to know." The truth was, Dom Caruso had been fighting his own battle in the past few weeks, a battle that had taken him from the Indian subcontinent to Central America, and then to Europe, as he tried to stop a potentially devastating intelligence leak from falling into the hands of the Iranians. The rest of the team had been kept away from the situation, but Dom didn't know until now that the others had not even been informed he'd been in harm's way. Hendley knew what Dom had been involved in, but apparently he'd kept the others in the dark. Operational security. He could already hear Hendley saying it as an explanation, and it did make sense, although it made Dom feel even more like he'd been swinging in the wind alone on his last operation. Ryan said, "Tell me about it. You get into anything interesting?" "Later," Dom replied, not sure if he would say anything about it at all now. "I heard you guys were out on a job. Anything cool happen?" Jack shrugged, then put his arm around Caruso's shoulders. "Let's grab a cup of coffee, and I'll fill you in." John Clark arrived in his fourth floor office just after 8, and as soon as he put his briefcase down, he picked up his phone and called Jack Ryan Jr.'s office down the hall. Jack answered on the second ring. Hey, John. I'm guessing Dom is in there shooting the shit with you. Jack chuckled. We have a little catching up to do.
Right. Before you do that, send him down to me.
You got it.
A minute later, Caruso entered Clark's office and shut the door behind him. The two men shook hands. Clark said, I meant to call you before you came in, but we had an in extremis situation come up last week.
Yeah, I heard. No details yet, but Jack was getting around to it.
He doesn't seem to be aware of what I've been up to.
Jerry and I have decided to keep some of the work we do here compartmentalized. You were working your last job as a singleton. When an operator is in the field as a singleton, there is no need to know among the other operators.
Dom said, I understand that.
Good. The matter was settled. Caruso wouldn't talk about his operation to the rest of the team.
How do you feel? Ready to get back to work?
Absolutely. I'm good to go.
Clark said, I need to fill you in on what went down in Vietnam. We have a 9 a.m. meeting where we might get further marching orders on the subject.
Dom pulled up a chair.
Let's hear it.
Chapter 10. 1 year earlier. A motorcade of 5 armored luxury vehicles rolled up to the same outer perimeter checkpoint that Mining Director Huang passed an hour earlier. The lead car handed over some credentials to the uniformed guard, and soon all 5 vehicles were moving again along the virtually empty blacktop road, much faster than the entourage from the Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation. They sailed through the other checkpoints without even slowing down, rising through the wooded hills toward their destination. The motorcade stopped at the entrance to residence number 55, and 18 men in total disgorged from it, all wearing gray military uniforms, signifying them as officers of the Korean People's Army. Their creds were checked here again by a large unit of armed guards, but only briefly, and soon the entourage had passed through the doors of the palace. At the nucleus of this group was Lieutenant General Ri Tae-jin, a fit 52-year-old who wore a chest full of medals and walked pridefully, chin first and shoulders back. His face was blank, void of emotion, though in the stony gaze a perceptive person might well notice an air of sadness. 6 of his staff remained in the entry hall. They were just along as escort, but they were not needed for today's meeting. And 6 more stopped off in an inner chamber for consultation with Politburo members in concurrent talks at the residence. 5 men followed Ri through another guarded doorway, heading for the personal residence of the Supreme Leader. They ascended a flight of stairs and entered the long main gallery hall, and here Ri glanced at a clock on the wall and saw he was right on time for his meeting with the Daewon Su, which meant to him he would probably have to sit and wait for only an hour or so. Ji-hoon's father hadn't been punctual himself, really, but Ji-hoon seemed to take exceptional pleasure in making people wait for him. Halfway down the main gallery hall, Ri and his entourage encountered a smaller group of men in civilian dress approaching from the living quarters of the Supreme Leader. There were 5 men in this group, and they were led by one of the residence's beautiful young attendants. The Lieutenant General identified one man in the group as the senior member because the attendant spoke to him, and the others walked behind. As he passed the man, their eyes met, and Ri saw he was a small man with a bald head, a few years older than himself. It bothered General Ri greatly that he did not recognize the man, because he'd obviously just left an audience with the Supreme Leader. If this bald-headed fellow had the ear of the Daewon Su, and he wasn't at least a general, then he was most definitely an important person. And if he wasn't even in the military, Ri felt he had no excuse for not knowing the man's file backward and forward. Ri was the nation's newly installed foreign intelligence chief, which meant there was no reason he would necessarily know every visitor to residence number 55. That would be a job for the Ministry of State Security, the domestic arm of North Korean intelligence. But with every generalship in the Korean People's Army came the responsibility of deft
political relationship making. Renew the important people in this town, in this government. But he didn't know this little man. As he walked, he tilted his head toward an aide who spoke without being spoken to, because he knew what his general wanted. Softly, he said, "Huang Min-ho, installed last week as the new director of Korea Natural Resources Trading." Ri nodded, as though he already knew this. He had heard the name, and he knew of the appointment. Ri had also heard of the order to have Huang's boss snatched from his house in his bedclothes and helicoptered up to a re-education camp, and he imagined that bastard would be dead inside 6 weeks. Re-education complete, he thought to himself as he walked on. The general wondered about this Huang. "I want his file. Contact MSS. Generate a reason." His voice echoed off the wooden flooring, and Huang might have heard him had the footfalls of a dozen men and women not echoed along with it. A few minutes later, Ri had left the last vestiges of his entourage behind, and now he sat alone in a gilded office. He knew Choi had a dozen of these offices at a dozen palaces in the country, and he'd been to many meetings in this and other similar rooms, but never had he been left by himself in one. This was strange. He did not know why he had been summoned here today and then sequestered from his aides. Perhaps it was a formality, a way to welcome him into his new position at the Reconnaissance General Bureau, although that didn't seem plausible. If that had been the case, surely there would be attendants and transcriptionists and photographers galore ready to witness the event. So this was something else. But what? Ri had served in the military intelligence field for more than a quarter century already, and he was a brilliant man. But at the moment, he couldn't come up with a scenario that made sense. Although the man he would soon have an audience with held the power of life and death over every civilian in the nation, he wasn't worried about himself in the least. He knew that if Choi wanted him dead, he wouldn't be meeting with him personally. Those things happened by proxy, as Ri Tae-jin was painfully well aware. Lieutenant General Ri had received exactly 2 orders from the Office of the Supreme Leader in the 1 week he had been in charge of the RGB. The first order was that Ri carry out the arrest of his predecessor. This he did reluctantly. He had worked with General Gong for more than a decade, and quite liked the old man. Gong's crime was the recent failure of a long-range ballistic missile test. ICBMs, like the one that had exploded over the ocean, were the responsibility of the Korean People's Army Missile Guidance Bureau, and General Gong's Reconnaissance General Bureau wasn't directly involved in making missiles fly. Several directors at MGB were arrested, but RGB was implicated as well, because a long-standing RGB plan to steal guidance software from a French aerospace company via a hacking operation had recently failed. Choi lumped that failure together with the unsuccessful missile test, and he ordered the directors of both the MGB and the RGB hauled out of their offices in disgrace. The second message from Choi came down to Ri later that same day. It was a short, direct missive, ordering Ri to put General Gong to death within 24 hours to pay for his disgrace. At the bottom of the page, one additional word had been added to the order. The word specified the manner of the execution. Dogs. Ri had sat alone in his office for 15 minutes, stunned and sickened, with the order held loosely in his fingertips, until a ringing phone brought him back to life. It was a senior minister from Choi's office. His words carried the weight of the Daewon Su, asking if the order had been understood. There was no problem there. Ree understood the order perfectly. His old mentor was to be fed to a pack of 7 starving dogs that were maintained at Chongjin labor camp for just such a purpose. He confirmed to the minister the order would be followed with utmost haste. But there was something else. The minister directed Ree himself to monitor the execution in order to ensure it was carried out to the letter of the instructions. Ree said he understood and would comply, but he knew the real reason he would have to travel to Chongjin and watch his friend and mentor die a horrific death before his eyes. He was being forced to watch the event because, as the new director, his cooperation was to be encouraged, and the best way for that, Troy and his ministers had decided, was by him learning in detail what would happen to him if he failed in his duties. It took a tremendous amount of horror to impress the new director of the North Korean Foreign Intelligence Service, but since the day of his director's death by the gnashing teeth of 7 dogs a week earlier, Lieutenant General Ree Tae-jin had had a recurring nightmare of the event. In his dream, he was never the one in the pit, although that could easily be the reality if Choi lost confidence in his ability to execute the duties of his office. Instead, he was a witness to the execution. His nightmare was virtually the same as the actual event. As he sat in the gilded ceremonial office, Ree's mind drifted to the dog pit, and then it moved to one further horror. It became known at the RGB soon after Gong's death that his family had been executed as well. His wife, his 3 adult children, and their wives, and even their small children, had all been taken to Chongjin and shot in the dead of night. No criminal complaint had been read to them, no explanation at all for why they had to die. Ree had trouble pushing his impure thoughts about his society out of his head, but they cleared quickly when a group of transcriptionists, generals, bodyguards, and then finally the Daewon Su himself entered. Troy carried a snifter of cognac in one hand and a handkerchief in the other. He wore his black Mao suit. Ree had seen him in nothing else save for a uniform he sometimes wore for purely military events. Ree also saw that Choi's eyes were typically active, flashing around the room, both on the general in front of him and at random objects. Choi looked at a clock, a container of water, a painting of his father on the wall. Without preamble, he said, "You had no involvement over the failed operation to obtain the guidance software from France." Ree did not know if it was a question or a statement. He shook his head. "None, Daewon Su. I was not involved in our cyber operations at all." Troy seemed to know this already. "General Gong's failures do not cast a shadow over you. You have my full confidence." Ree bowed 4 times and thanked his supreme leader, who seemed content to watch him bow. Then Choi said, "Missile Guidance Bureau must do better, but General Gong had an opportunity to provide them with assistance, and he failed." Ree knew what was good for him. He agreed in a full-throated manner. Choi then looked at his drink and said, "My burden is this. Like my father and my grandfather, I am a keen expert on matters of history. This is well known by all, Daewon Su. Nothing has struck me more than what has happened in Ukraine, in Libya, in Iraq. When these nations parted with their most potent weapons, they were not rewarded with good relations. No, they became non-entities. Lambs." "Yes," Ree said. "Okay, So we are, in fact, going to talk about the problems at Missile Guidance Bureau. Choi sipped the cognac. We must produce better rockets, able to fly further and more reliably. We must develop. I agree completely, Rhee said. Choi was used to hearing this, of course, no matter the topic. The last time Choi Ji-hoon had heard the words, I disagree, he was 9 years old. The plutonium weapons are in our arsenal. Our uranium enrichment is progressing. We have miniaturized the bombs into warheads. Our nation has the power, but not the mechanism to deliver the power. We need a ballistic missile capable of delivering the warhead. Now Rhee cocked his head in surprise. I am told the Rodong system performed flawlessly in its most recent test. My eyes have been focused outward at RGB. Have I been misinformed? Choi waved a hand. Rodong has a range of 900 kilometers. This makes it merely a defensive weapon. Yes, we can obliterate Seoul, but this will not protect us from America. They would gladly sacrifice South Korea in order to destroy us in North Korea. We need something with the range to reach the continental United States. The Taipodong 2 is not operational, and despite what I am being told by RGB, I don't think it soon will be. Rhee assumed his nation's military leaders had received an earful from their Grand Marshal. Fortunately for Rhee, however, he and his department had not been given responsibility for the development of the ballistic systems. Unfortunately for Rhee, he feared this was about to change. Choi leaned forward. Our military, our scientists, they have been unable to provide us with the technology we need. I want you to go out and get it. Rhee thought of the non-proliferation sanctions, of the naval blockade that checked shipping cargo in the Yellow Sea and the Sea of Japan. He thought of the tight controls on the manufacture and sale of items involved in the construction of all things rocket, including dual-use items that the West feared might be smuggled into North Korea. In short, he thought of the dozens of barriers in front of him. But he said the only thing he could say. Of course, Daewon-soo, I will not fail. You have 3 years. Now he thought of the seven dogs of Chongjin, and he wondered if they were already hungry again after consuming General Gong. 3 years? 3 years for... 3 years to see that the Taipodong 2 is operational with our Missile Guidance Bureau. A purple vein on Rhee's forehead pulsed a few times, but he made no overt reaction. That is not much time. 3 years is more time than I should give you. Does our nation have 3 years before our enemies attack? In a measured tone, the general said, I confess, I do not know. No, you don't. The only thing that will stop an attack is the Taipodong 2. Operational and dependable. Our nuclear scientists have done their job. They have successfully miniaturized the device. But we have to be able to deliver it to the United States mainland. Choi held up three fingers. 3 years. 3 years until I find someone else. Rhee knew what would happen to him if Choi decided to find someone else. Chapter 11. Present Day. Shortly before 9 a.m., three large Chevy Suburbans rolled into the garage under the North Fairfax Street offices of Hendley Associates. The vehicles pulled up to an entrance,
and out of view from the street all the doors on all the Suburbans opened as one, and a phalanx of young armed men stepped out. Soon a distinguished 63-year-old woman climbed out of the center vehicle and moved purposefully to the entrance, where she was greeted by Jerry Hendley, ex-South Carolina senator and the director of both Hendley Associates and the campus. Jerry thought Director of National Intelligence Mary Pat Foley looked tired and worn. He knew she had been working hard since taking over the DNI job. She was the top intelligence official of the top intelligence community in the world, after all, so there was no surprise the position came with long hours and high stress. But even so, Jerry saw in Mary Pat a deep concern. Together, the two of them rode the elevator up to the fourth-floor conference room. On the way up, Mary Pat said, "I like the new place." She tried to smile, but Jerry had known Mary Pat and her husband Ed for years, and he could tell she was just going through the motions of small talk. He made it easy on her. "Thanks very much. We were lucky to get the place. A private military contractor gave it up, and we moved in. It was stocked for our needs. We basically just switched out the locks and plugged in our computers." She nodded politely. Jerry said, "I'm very sorry about Colin Hazelton." "You knew him well, did you?" Mary Pat nodded again, but made no reply. A minute later, they entered the conference room. The five men sitting at the table stood and came forward. John Clark, Domingo Chavez, Dominic Caruso, Sam Driscoll, and Jack Ryan Jr. all shook hands with the DNI before sitting back down. Mary Pat was here this morning because the campus had been sent to Vietnam on her personal request. As DNI, Mary Pat had every intelligence asset in the U.S. government at her disposal, but she had reached out to Jerry Hendley and his team for help in the matter of Colin Hazelton, because she wanted to keep the inquiry sensitive and below official channels. Needless to say, she now felt that decision to have been a grave error. John Clark began the meeting by running through everything that had happened between the time the campus team arrived in Ho Chi Minh City and the moment their Gulfstream took off over the Gulf of Thailand with the body of Colin Hazelton hidden behind an access panel. He had the other members of the unit give their own perspective on specific events. Mary Pat sat quietly throughout the presentations, but she looked nearly overcome with emotion when Domingo relayed finding the wounded Hazelton in the street and his attempts to save him. Ding had never seen Mary Pat like this, and he quickly toned down the level of detail in an attempt to spare her some discomfort. Mary Pat seemed skeptical when she heard that Colin had written the letters DPRK in his last note, and she asked to look at the paper herself. Clark handed it over, and she had as much trouble deciphering the letters as the others. When everyone was finished with the after-action report, Mary Pat took a moment to collect her thoughts. She said, "I could have stopped this before it got out of hand." "I didn't know the stakes," she said. "Had I known. Christ. I thought this was just a corporate intelligence issue. Shady, maybe. Crooked at worst. But not this." Clark replied softly, "I wouldn't be surprised if Hazelton thought it was just a corporate intelligence issue as well. His threat posture didn't indicate he thought for a second he was in any physical danger." Mary Pat then said, "I feel I know the answer, but I have to rule it out, so I will ask anyway. Any chance at all this was just random street crime?" Jack Jr. took this one. "None. I was the one watching when he was confronted. These guys were skilled. They locked on to Hazelton and trailed him for blocks. I don't know why he was targeted or killed, but I do know there wasn't anything random to it." Foley seemed satisfied by the answer, though she was still visibly upset. Jerry said, "Now, Mary Pat, it should come as no surprise we have questions for you. Why did you have us tail Hazelton? I assumed you suspected him of being involved in something illegal."
She took a sip of water. Colin, Ed, and I came up in CIA together. He'd been a pilot in the Air Force who'd moved into intelligence. He was a natural case officer. One of the good ones. After leaving the field, he worked for Ed for years on the 7th floor of the agency and became a trusted confidant to us both. When I moved out of CIA and began running the National Counterterrorism Center, I wanted to move Colin over with me. As always, a special personal security review was run on him, just a formality because he'd been in CIA for 30 years already. But the review turned up some problems.
Problems? Jerry asked.
Money problems. Colin had made some questionable investments. He put all of his savings in places where he thought the money would earn an especially high rate of return. High risk, third world locations that others wouldn't touch. Colin felt like he knew the region.
What happened?
Mary Pat's chest heaved. The Arab Spring. Tunisia flipped, Libya tanked, Egypt went one way, then the other, and then in another direction.
Ryan whistled.
Damn. Hazleton invested in North Africa?
Mary Pat shrugged.
He'd made some good bets in the past. He grew overconfident in his ability to foresee events. And that proved his undoing. He borrowed some money, thinking he could earn it back. He lost that as well. When we found out about the investments, they were still going strong. Nevertheless, we couldn't take him at NCTC. There was too much potential for compromise with all that money offshore. Then CIA found he had failed to report some of his accounts. He said it was just a screw-up on his part, and I believe him. Colin was a good pilot and a first-rate intelligence officer, and he was a good executive from a big-picture standpoint. But he could be a bit disorganized when it came to paperwork. At that point in his CIA career, he was no longer clandestine. He was a 7th floor administrator. Personally, I thought he should have been allowed to retire. But the new head of CIA, Jay Canfield, is a by-the-book guy. So he drummed Hazleton out a year before eligibility for his pension. Shortly after that was the coup in Egypt. Colin lost everything. He was out of work and desperate. Ed and I tried to help him on a personal level, but he was too proud. He wouldn't return our calls. I'd gotten a tip from another old colleague that he'd started working for Duke Sharps in New York. I knew Duke before he left FBI's counterintelligence division. Since he's gone private sector, he's only become an unscrupulous opportunist. John Clark said, "That man is scum of the earth." Ding agreed with a nod, but the younger campus operators all exchanged looks of surprise. Mary Pat also agreed. Sharp's Global Intelligence Partners employs hundreds of ex-spies, soldiers, and police detectives all over the planet, and Duke has his fingerprints on most every shady event happening anywhere. Still, there's one thing Duke has more of than morally questionable ex-spooks, and that's lawyers. His operation is stayed up and running even though the Justice Department has tried to shut him down. Jerry Hendley said, "When you found out Hazleton worked for Sharps, what did you do?" At first I was just disappointed, but not terribly concerned. Some of Sharps's clients skirt the law, sure, but he also works with above-board corporate accounts on completely benign investigative issues. I didn't believe for an instant that Colin would do anything against the U.S. Still, I put some resources into him, flagged his passport to ping if he went abroad, just in case. Then the other day, he flew to Prague. I wanted him followed there, but he left the Czech Republic before we got anyone in place and went to Vietnam. Our assets there were deployed on another matter, and I didn't want to alert the local authorities. So I called you, Jerry, and asked for help. John, you and your men tailed him in Ho Chi Minh City. I had no idea he was in any danger. I just wanted to know if he was involved in something illegal. Jerry could see that Mary Pat felt a sense of responsibility for what happened to Hazelton. He said, "You didn't get him killed. He met with some misfortune, yes, but a lot of it was self-inflicted." "I know that, Jerry. But if you work in the intelligence field long enough, you really covet those few who've been with you all the way. He was a good man, and a hell of an officer. If not so much in his later years, at least long ago. Ed and I both owed him a lot." It was quiet in the conference room for a moment. Then Clark cleared his throat and said, "Unfortunately, we weren't able to discern anything about the assassins. We had to leave the area before checking the body of the man I killed." Mary Pat replied, "I'm just glad you guys got out of there alive." Ryan pulled out his iPad. "Shortly before he was killed, however, Hazelton met with a woman. They had a short but apparently heated discussion. We didn't get audio, but she was after something he was carrying, or at least something she thought he was carrying. She didn't get it." Ryan pulled up the picture of the tall blonde sitting at the table with Hazelton, and Mary Pat leaned forward and looked at it. "I don't know her. Email it to me and I'll have NSA run facial recog on it." Jack said, "We tried that. No luck." Mary Pat raised an eyebrow. "Are you saying your facial recognition software here at the campus is as good or better than the U.S. government's?" "In truth, it was the same system. IT Director Gavin Beery had the ability to plug into the NSA's database of images and use the same software the CIA was using." Mary Pat did not know this. Jerry broke in quickly. "We're not saying that at all. Jack will be happy to email you the images of the young woman. Hopefully you'll get lucky." Mary Pat let the matter go, and she stood, indicating the end to the meeting. "Look, gentlemen, I am concerned about whatever Hazelton was working on, of course, especially if it involved North Korea. But I put you guys on this operation because I was worried about an old friend, not because I wanted you in danger. And now that old friend is dead. I'll make inquiries. I don't want you or your team risking your lives over this any longer. There are enough other problems on Earth right now. I'm not going to push the campus into the unknowns of some sort of corporate crime problem, even if there was an assumption by Hazelton that North Korea had something to do with it. This is probably drugs, money laundering, even gun running. State will work with the local authorities to find out whatever they can. That will have to be good enough." Mary Pat Foley left a short time later, and then Jerry Hendley sat back down with his five operators to discuss their options. Ding said, "Don't know about you, Jerry, but I'm pretty damn curious about those dudes who almost punched our ticket in Vietnam." "Me too," admitted both Ryan and Driscoll. Clark was more diplomatic. "We're all just back to regular operational duty. We aren't tasked on anything specific yet, so our workload is light enough at the moment to where maybe we can dig a little deeper." Hendley thought it over first, but soon enough he said, "Don't worry. We're not dropping it. I think it's safe to operate under the assumption that whoever killed Colin Hazelton knew who he was. That means there is a bad actor out there with no qualms about killing ex-CIA executives. As far as I'm concerned, that warrants our attention, whether or not we have any official blessing from the DNI. Ding smiled. "I was hoping you'd say that. Any idea what our next step is?" Clark answered, "I've got an idea. I just didn't want to burden Mary Pat with it." Jerry sighed. He knew, and he wasn't sure he liked it. "Duke Sharps?" "Yeah. but we're not about to start snooping on American citizens on the streets of New York. Not yet, anyway. For now, we probe a little in open source to see what we can find out about Sharps and his operation. Anything too overt, and he'll pick up on it. He and his employees are extremely good about their own security. Sharp's global intelligence partners will be a tough nut to crack.
Chapter 12. 1 year earlier. The offices of Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation were in the Chung-gyok, or Central District of Pyongyang, the nation's capital of 2.5 million. It was a large building complex with a tower in the center and several smaller buildings also associated with the mining industry nearby. Mining was the largest sector of the North Korean economy, employing thousands just here at the administration offices in Pyongyang, and a million more around the nation. And for the past 2 weeks, at the top of the entire hierarchy sat Hwang Min-ho, and this continued to amaze him each and every morning. As the son of employees of a party elite, Hwang Min-ho was given opportunities not afforded to 99% of his nation's children. Still, as with every citizen of North Korea, his future was ordained by the party. He was sent to study engineering at Beijing University, and then he was ordered to further his studies at Pyongyang University, where he earned the equivalent of a master's degree in public policy. He began his career as a Korean Workers' Party administrator in the Chagang province. Chagang was one of the centers of the coal industry in the country, and Hwang's engineering background helped him in his dealings with the problems faced by the mines. It was a natural thing for him to move from the Korean Workers' Party into the state-run mining entity, and by the age of 30 he was well ensconced in the administrative division of Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation. He met his first wife at a Workers' Party meeting when they were both still teenagers, but she had died on her 22nd birthday while giving birth to a stillborn child. In that instant, Hwang went from family man to bachelor, and it affected him greatly. He focused wholly on his career for the next 20 years, until finally meeting a young nurse at a copper mine in Ryanggang province. Min-ho and So-ra were married a year later. His intelligence, calm demeanor, and work ethic all made him a standout, and over the next 2 decades he rose through the ranks to the top echelon of the organization, finding himself the director of the coal and copper mining sectors of his company by age 50. When the rare earth mineral deposits were discovered at Chungju in Pyeonggangbuk-do province, many of the highest members of the company switched their focus to working with the Chinese on this new natural resource. Hwang, by contrast, remained focused on the nation's established mining operations, and by keeping his head down and concentrating on coal and copper, when the smoke cleared after the Chungju, China debacle, Hwang was virtually the only top-level executive in the organization left standing. He was ordered to take the reins of the organization when the director was imprisoned, and though it was the proudest moment in his life, as well as the lives of his wife, children, and elderly parents, he would have much rather remained focused on coal and copper. Nevertheless, now he was in charge, and he could no longer save himself by staying away from the rare earth mine. In fact, it had become 80% of his work. Since the Chinese were still partnering with North Korea at the copper mines and the zinc mines and the tungsten mine and the near-dormant gold mines, he felt certain no issue at any of those locations would get him thrown into Kangdong re-education camp, so he knew his time was best spent concerning himself with the mining sector that, if not exploited in the next year and a half, would result in his being tossed into the back of an armored truck and rolled to Kangdong. Hwang was father to a boy of 9 and a girl of 8, and he considered himself a family man. But like all men in North Korea, his first allegiance was to the state and not his family.
So this morning he rose before dawn and met his driver in front of his house in an elite neighborhood that overlooked the Taedong River. They drove silently together on the wide, empty boulevards. It was still dark, and in the capital city there were very few lighted streets, as electricity was in such short supply, but the large neon propaganda billboards on top of the tall apartment blocks and office buildings glowed dazzlingly, and bright spotlights ringed the large statues of Choi Ji-hoon that stood in the center of major intersections and traffic circles. The drive took more than 20 minutes, and after another 10 minutes walking through darkened corridors and climbing 7 flights of stairs, Huang Min-ho was hunched over a laptop on his desk with the day's first cup of tea in his hand. By the noon hour, Huang felt like this day would turn out like most every other, much work with little definite to show for it. Also like every other day, he was getting nowhere in his attempts to advance the situation at Chungju. This morning he had suffered through a meeting with representatives of Korea General Machinery Trading Company, the state-owned manufacturer and importer of hydroelectric generators, and he had spent the better part of an hour both berating them for not fulfilling their promises from their last meeting and begging them to do a better job this time in their pledge to increase the electrical output to the mine. He'd received platitudes from the contingent, but little else. Now he was prepping for an afternoon visit to Amrogong Development Banking Corporation a few blocks away. Huang and his vice ministers were desperately trying to secure financing from abroad to purchase those few goods not enveloped by sanctions, and perhaps even find an overseas benefactor who would bankroll them outright. Huang's resources in country were limited, thanks to both the nation's inefficiencies and the sanctions regime put upon them by the West, and he saw Amrogong Development as the thinnest and most fragile lifeline imaginable, but a lifeline nonetheless. As he reached for the cup containing the dregs of his third tea of the day, his secretary's slightly agitated voice squawked over the intercom.
"Director Huang, apologies, but there is a General Ri here to see you."
Huang cocked his head. He had no idea who this man was. He knew dozens of men named Ri, many of whom were military officers, but he wasn't planning on talking to any of them today. "Does he have an appointment?" Unannounced visits among government executives were unheard of. Even at the lowest levels, preparations would need to be made, and Huang was director of the state-owned company that ran the largest industrial sector in the nation, so any meeting should have been on the agenda for days. There was a pause, then almost a shriek from his secretary.
"I am very sorry, sir. He is coming in."
Huang rose hurriedly as the door opened. There before him was a general in the green uniform of the Korean People's Army, with an impressive chest full of medals. Huang thought he remembered seeing him the week before, during his visit to residence number 55. Huang's heart skipped a beat. He said, "Jeonun Chepademnika, am I under arrest?" "Anyo, Dongmu." "No, comrade. Apologies for coming unannounced." He stepped up to Huang's desk and bowed. "General Ri Tae-jin of the RGB." Huang bowed. "Foreign intelligence? What can I do for you?" He shrugged. "I've never even been out of the country." Ri smiled a little, but Huang thought the man looked either tired or sad. "I am not here to hire you on as an agent. May I sit down?"
"I will call for some tea."
"No. Let us just talk." Ri took the chair in front of the desk, and Huang sat slowly in his own chair. This brash general with the sad face seemed to have taken charge here in Huang's office. This was not the way meetings were held, and Huang was utterly confused. When both men were seated, General Ri said, "I congratulate you on your recent appointment. I, too, only took the reins at RGB 2 weeks ago. I extend to you my congratulations and best wishes, comrade. May you bring honor to the Daewon Su. I am aware of your predicament, Rhee said abruptly. Huang looked around the room. My predicament? Yes. You have been given 18 months to turn a slag pit in the mountains north of Chongzhu into the largest high-tech mineral mine in the world. The Chinese, the only business partner with the ability to make this happen, have been thrown out of the mine because the Daewon Su's demand that they provide us with ICBMs was rejected out of hand. You cannot work with Western businesses in this endeavor in any legal sense, because the nations with the technology and expertise we need have restrictions imposed on business travel and high-tech exports. And there is great risk that the crippling sanctions against our nation will only squeeze you tighter. Huang just looked back at the man. It was all true. But it was not the Juchi way to complain or to even bring up the hardships. Rhee continued, You will not succeed. And you saw what happened to your predecessor, so you are aware of the ramifications of failure. Huang puffed his chest out a little. I am working diligently to ensure the mine reaches full output in the required time. Work all you want. In fact, work up until the minute they drag you from behind that desk in chains. It will not happen without a lot of help. What is it I can do for you, General? Somehow, the already stiff and stern-looking general managed to sit up even more erect. You and I have something in common, Huang. We both have a countdown clock in our heads. I have been ordered to secure for the DPRK both the hardware and the know-how to produce a successful and working ICBM. I have been given 3 years, so twice as long as you. I would feel lucky if my task were not even more difficult than yours. Huang was both confused and nervous now. What you are telling me is not in my normal purview. There are security concerns in telling this to... I don't care about that. You aren't going to violate security. I've read every word of your personnel and intelligence file. You are no risk to anyone.
Yes. Of course not.
Go on, please, General Rhee. We have something else in common. A wife who is good, and 2 children who rely on us. If the only result of my failure would be my own demise, it would be a small worry. Huang said, My own life is not important. I live to bring strength and prosperity to the Daewon Su. It was official party doctrine, communist ideology and personality cult. And General Rhee did not disagree with it. But he did deflect it. Well, Huang, if we succeed, we will both bring strength and prosperity to the Daewon Su and save our families. Certainly you agree that would be a suitable outcome. Huang just nodded. You have 1.5 years to produce, process, and market rare earth metal. I have 3 years to acquire an operational ICBM. He smiled thinly. As it stands now, we will both fail, which means I will live exactly 1.5 years longer than you. Huang shrugged. If I fail, I fail. There are things worse than being shot by firing squad. Rhee leapt to his feet, a wild look in his eyes. You are right about that, and I have seen those worse things. They fed my predecessor, General Gong, to starving dogs. It took him 2 minutes and 40 seconds before he stopped resisting, and they ripped out his throat. Which means that for 2 minutes and 39 seconds, he saw and felt and knew his fate. I have executed hundreds of men in my career. I will oversee an execution tomorrow morning, in fact. But what happened to General Gong was truly a horror no man should ever endure. Huang's face blanched. And that's not all. His family paid for his failure with their lives. Huang knew the families of traitors were often put to death. It wasn't a hidden practice. On the contrary, the military wanted it to be known that the ramifications for defying the state extended past the life of the culprit. It was a way to encourage families to inform on members who were a threat to the society as a whole. Ri continued, "Fail Choi as spectacularly as Gong did, and you will suffer the same fate. I might even be ordered to witness your fate. And you should hope I am there, because while the dogs are ripping your flesh, you will have the small comfort of knowing I will be there in the pen 18 months after you." "Are you just here to commiserate with me?" "No. I am telling you all this so you know that the two of us need one another." "What are you proposing?" Ri smiled at Huang. "I am proposing a partnership between our organizations. Between ourselves, in fact." "A partnership? I do not understand. Your efforts are doomed to fail without outside help. I can get you that help. That which you need is all outside our borders, and I am the man who can go out and get it and bring it back. You need foreign partnership, not from China, but someone else. Someone who can acquire the goods and know-how and get them here, and someone who can take the metal and sell it quietly on the world market. What do you want in return?" 20%. 20% of what? 20% of everything. Direct into the coffers of the Ministry of Intelligence. Within 1 year, this will triple my budget. With such monies, I will be able to attain the technology we need." Huang cracked a smile. "The Chinese say the mine is worth $12 trillion. You think I have authority to divert 20% of $12 trillion? I think you can figure out a way if it keeps you out of the labor camps and your children alive. I have access to a network of international bank accounts. I can help you divert payments. And $12 trillion will be over the life of the mine. I only need to use the promise of your mine to generate foreign investment, which I can use for my ICBM operation." "You are going to buy a missile?" "No. I am going to buy a missile industry." The smile on Huang's face returned. "You don't lack for confidence." "It is not confidence. It is inspiration." Ri leaned forward. "Nothing so inspiring as watching your predecessor being eaten alive by hunger-crazed animals." Huang cringed, then said, "Just tell me what you want, Ri." "No. You tell me what you want, and I will make it happen. I will use as much of my budget on this project as necessary. I'll shut down desks, departments, stations, and move resources. I will task foreign operatives. I will devote all my energies into this operation." "Operation?
I'm sorry, Rhee. I don't understand what you think you can do to help me mine and process rare earth minerals in Chungju.
Let me give you some examples of what I can do. I can bribe UN officials to loosen sanctions on banks and trade. I will hire armies of Western spies to infiltrate rare earth facilities all over the globe to learn that which you need to know. I will make deals with mining companies abroad to bring them on board in a clandestine fashion to help you with their expertise. I will offer secret employment contracts to chemists, geologists, engineers. You handpick the people you want, and I will go out and get them, at gunpoint if necessary. I will organize deliveries of the goods you need and see that they make it past sanctions and embargo enforcement ships in the Yellow Sea. I will work with allies in Russia who can hack the computer systems of relevant industry to help you with blueprints. I will fund public relations initiatives around the world to make sure the market is accepting of your product once it's ready to export. Huang had never heard anything like this in his life. Of course, his office had made requests for information from foreign intelligence, but what Rhee was offering was on a scale exponentially larger than anything he had ever considered. Rhee was outlining just exactly all the things he needed to create a successful mining and processing operation at Chungju. "Incredible," he said. "If you can do this, we have a chance."
"So, you agree?"
What did he have to lose?
"I agree."
Rhee said, "I need to establish partnerships outside of our nation to create the conduits necessary to make this happen. If you had any suggestions for companies or personalities I should seek out to join us in our endeavor, I would like to hear them."
Huang nodded instantly. "One name comes to mind. You get him involved as a benefactor, and you and I might just make this happen."
The intelligence chief raised his eyebrows.
"Tell me."
"Oscar Robles de Mota." Rhee nodded thoughtfully. He knew all about this man.
"Oscar Robles."
"Why, yes. Of course."
Chapter 13. Present Day. The small house on Jayhawk Street in Annandale, Virginia, showed its first signs of life most mornings at 6. 43-year-old Annette Brawley tapped the alarm clock, rolled up into a sitting position on her bed, and flipped on a light that shone through the curtains, out across the tiny yard and into the narrow street. She spent a few moments sitting on her bed, rubbing her eyes and dealing with the frustration that today was only Tuesday, and then she stood on tired legs. As soon as she was up, she made her bed. It was an old habit from her days in the army, more than 8 years removed now, and the process was especially quick and straightforward because no one slept with her, so she needed to remake only her side. She then entered her kitchen and hit the button on the coffee pot and grabbed a carton of eggs from the fridge. She pulled two cereal bowls out of the cupboard. This was about the time her head cleared enough for her to shut off her body's autopilot and actually think about what she was doing. She fixed breakfast for two. Then, at 6:15 on the nose, she walked down the narrow hall to the back of the house, took a narrow flight of stairs up, and then knocked on the door at the top of the landing. After knocking, she opened the door, because she knew knocking was only a formality and no one would answer, and she would therefore need to use more active measures to accomplish this daily task. Stephanie Brawley was 16, and she liked getting up in the morning even less than her mom did. She also didn't like her mom very much, so she was doubly surly each and every time she awoke to a hoarse and tired female voice.
Time to get up, Steph. I made you some eggs. I hate you, Stephanie croaked. I know, honey, Annette calmly replied, wiping sleep from her eyes as she turned away. I made you some cereal, too.
Turn off the light!
Annette left her daughter's room with the light on. She was subjected to a litany of insults as she retreated back downstairs to her coffee cup. Getting yelled at each morning had become part of her daily routine. She didn't like it. It saddened and depressed her, but she did her best to keep a bit of perspective. Annette herself had lived with her mom after her parents divorced, and she'd been no great joy to be around during her teenage years. No, she'd probably been rough on her mother. And now, as Stephanie berated her each morning, she tried to tell herself this phase was just the payback of karma, and it would pass soon enough. Annette had lived alone since her husband died in 2007. He was in the Pennsylvania National Guard, serving in Afghanistan as a staff sergeant working as an intelligence analyst at his battalion headquarters in Nangarhar Province. He was far from any combat, and Annette thought he must have had one of the safer military jobs in the country. But his armored Humvee ran over an explosively formed projectile, and he died instantly. Annette was Army Intelligence herself at the time, in active duty and serving just west of her husband in Kabul. 8-year-old Stephanie had been home in Pittsburgh with Annette's mother, and it had been doubly hard on her that her own mother was not home at the time she heard about her father's death. Yes, Stephanie's awful teenage years' behavior had an explanation, but Annette didn't let her use it as an excuse. After the trials of her daily morning ordeal getting her daughter up and out the door to school, Annette actually enjoyed the short drive down to Springfield to work. She was no longer in the army, but shortly before 8 a.m. she pulled through the gates of Fort Belvoir.